Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa's presidential lecture series gets underway tomorrow night with a lecture from noted conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. Thomas will be lecturing tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. He's a 10-time Grammy Award winner and received the National Medal of the Arts in 2010 from President Barack Obama. A third-generation artist who currently serves as musical director of the San Francisco Symphony, the founder and artistic director of the New World Symphony, a training orchestra for the world's top young orchestral musicians, and he's also the principal guest conductor of the London Symphony. Thomas's tenure at San Francisco has made international news for his revitalization of the orchestra, along with his emphasis on American music and contemporary music, which has been a trademark throughout his career. Over the years, he's recorded over 120 CDs of works ranging from the classics to contemporary masters, including his most recent recordings, which have been devoted to the music of John Adams, and a CD titled American Mavericks, devoted to the music of Henry Cowell, Lou Harrison, and Edgar Varese. The University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series will feature Michael Tilson Thomas tomorrow evening at 7:30, sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Endowed Chair, and he joins us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Michael Tilson Thomas, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My great pleasure, Rich.
You had a TED Talk earlier this year in which your father talked about the what and the how of music. It was
yes.
A really interesting story. What did he mean by the what and the how?
Well, he was speaking of this because he himself was a person of enormous gifts who had had no formal training really at anything in his life other than what he did kind of living in theaters, backstage in theaters. But nonetheless, he had immense abilities as an illustrator and in scenic design, many other areas. But he really was very much aware of his need to sort of invent himself always new technique for everything. And he wished that he had had much more how, much more technique of way about things, because he was such a mystical guy. He was so connected into the what of everything. So he used to say, yeah, the only thing that matters in art is what and how, and you have to know what it is about, what it's supposed to say, but then you also have to have this facility of the how of how to make it happen. And he said, you know, someone like me, I got all kinds of what, but the how stuff. On the other hand, I go to all these shows, I just see how, everyone's got all this how, but they haven't got any what. But where's the justice in all this? Sort of talk that kind of, you know, tough backstage Broadway guy.
Well, and hearing you speak, I mean, I think this is something that American orchestras sometimes lack, telling the what and why this music is important. And I think one of the things you illustrated in the talk is when you know the what and how of this music, it makes all the difference.
Sure, because, I mean, classical music does convey an incredible testimony, really, about how people have felt about things on many, many levels. And unlike pop music or folk music or, you know, kinds of music which mostly try and define the mood, the groove of one particular kind of moment. You know, so the, each particular song has a certain level of energy or laid-backness or, you know, kind of broody sophistication or, you know, kind of hyper-energetic flapperness. I'm thinking of the pop songs.
Uh-huh.
But it's only classical music, really, which has these forms where you have several different themes which represent different mental states and which are kind of contending with one another and arriving at new kinds of balances and mixtures in the way that I think our thoughts do.
I was struck by a quote you had at one point, and I may have been taking this out of context, but you said, sometimes classical musicians underestimate what music does best, and you referred to it as the transformation of moods and this very wide psychological voyage. Do you think musicians are aware of this? You know, a transfixing piece of music, that is the best part of one of these transcendental experiences you can have in a concert hall.
Sure. I mean, I think that's the way we all get into it. I mean, people's relationship to reactions to music is very emotional. I mean, it brings people together in a kind of way that perhaps no other art does. But then in the process of learning all of this, it's so technical. Something like classical music is so unbelievably technical. And you spend a lot of your life trying to get things right. You know, if the score has so many specifications and then you're playing with a lot of other people and trying to make sense together of how you feel about all these endlessly specific and sometimes ghoulishly obscure requests from these composers. So you can kind of get into, not seeing the forest for the trees mindset. And that's why it's so important, I think, that as we make our music, that we kind of kick ourselves backwards and forwards across the dividing line between, well, instinct and intelligence, as I described in that TED Talk you referred to.
Yeah. Now, you just referred to the ghoulish instincts of some composers. Give us a sense for those who are not in the orchestra. What are some of the demands that composers do make on the musicians that seem along those lines?
Well, increasingly, as notation has become more and more precise, the indications that the composer will have, you say, okay, I want you to play this note in this particular location, and I want it to be exactly this length. I don't want it to be a beat. I don't even want it to be a half a beat. I want it to be 1/7 of a beat, and then I want a 2/7 of a beat rest, and then this syncopation, which would be played across that beat into the next beat, and moreover, I want this note without vibrato and the next note with a little bit more sforzando and then this and so on. I mean, it just gets down to, you know, almost instant by instant imagination of how the sound could be made. In former times, much more of those abilities were just given over to the performers, you know, so that you'd be given a score that might have an expressive instruction that, like, play this irregularly or play this with capriciousness or fantasy or something like that, and then it was more up to the performer what that would be. But in the 20th century particularly, maybe as life grew more technical and specific, so the kind of demands that were being made on musicians developed in that same sort of way. Sometimes you would really have to kind of make yourself get through the kind of thicket, the kind of sometimes the ensnaring thicket of the notation just to get to where the music might be.
Well, certainly in the early 19th and late 18th century, really the composers laid out very little for the performer. It was part of a performance practice that they were expected to know and never written down, never really told. It was told from one generation of teachers to students.
Yes, I mean, there was much more freedom about all these things. I was looking at a set of parts a few years ago, of orchestral parts, that were used by Gustav Mahler, which are in a library in England somewhere. And these are not parts of his own symphonies. These are parts of Beethoven overtures and Weber overtures and Mozart symphonies and things like this. And it's really amazing in those parts how much he's marked for the players to do. Also with things like how many people are supposed to be playing. So he's always changing the numbers of people who are playing and giving them little specific instructions as to particular kinds of techniques that they might use to sort of almost relate to the score as if it were a kind of coloring book, I guess you could think of it that way, changing the balances and the sonorities and almost in the direction of the kind of thing that recording producers would do when that technology came along. How can you mix the piece is that kind of what his approach was.
Well, one of the things I really admire about your leadership of the San Francisco Symphony and New World Symphony as well has been this idea of exploring the what and how in your programming, about really taking listeners on a journey, putting unusual juxtapositions of music, and also widening the boundary of what an American symphony can play and should play. Certainly, you've championed American music, you've championed contemporary music, and for a good part of this last century, those were not things that audiences were perceived to want to hear. Why is that?
I don't know, really. I mean, there have been times and places in the 20th century when lots of contemporary music has still been done. I mean, conductors like Koussevitzky and Stokowski, to name just two, were very adventurous in music they presented. And even if you look back at programs that conductors like Klemperer did when he was a youngster, you'll see there's a lot of Bartok and Hindemith and Stravinsky and Berg and, all manner of things. So I think it's just that as the music business, the sort of institution of music making, has become more organized and more concerned with the quote, bottom lines, unquote, of the expenses and which are the most popular pieces and what can be most relied upon to bring in an audience that will be big enough and enthusiastic enough about coming again and again to just put the numbers of bottoms and the numbers of seats, as concert managers describe these things, that perhaps this has had an influence in some ways on making taste more conservative for some concert series. But, you know, it's really different in different towns, and I certainly know in the years I've been in San Francisco, about 18 years I've been there now, just by consistently taking an attitude of presenting unusual music and presenting music, though, that I really believed in as a performer. I've never presented music that I thought this is something akin to a physician prescribing you to take a very bitter medication because you're going to feel better tomorrow morning. I always presented a piece that there's something about the piece that really excited me, that enthused me, that opened my ears and opened my sense of wonder in what music could be. And in this way, I've described my role sometimes as being a kind of tour guide, in that if I were to take you on a trip on the ocean, let's say, and we were to go off on this cruise together, and along the way we came to an island which was uncharted. It existed on no map ever known. And as we looked at the island through our binoculars, we saw that on the shore it was teeming with flora and fauna such as never been described in any encyclopedia. Well, wouldn't that be a fantastic event? This is the kind of thing you dream of, that you really have seen something and experienced something that no one else has. And that's the same way I feel about programming music, that it's my responsibility as a kind of guide to introduce to the audience things which are way out beyond what they may have suspected music might be, and that's something that there can be controversy about. And I really need them. I need their reactions to that music to shape the adventure. And I think also it gives them something to talk about in the next weeks. I went to that concert last week. I mean, you can't believe I heard one of the strangest and most bizarre things. I never even thought music even could be anything like that. And what was that all about? But then there was also this really gorgeous other thing. And, you know, I mean, it's that same excitement that exists in the theater, in the sort of the world of the repertory theater, that it's about there being new experimental pieces as well as Aeschylus and Sophocles and Shakespeare and Steve Sondheim and whoever. So that's perhaps because I come from a theatrical family, my perspective on what the vibe, what the sense of excitement should be in a concert series.
My guest today is Michael Tilson Thomas, the music director of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, the founder and artistic director of the New World Symphony. He'll be the first guest lecturer for this year's University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series this Tuesday night at the Lorton Performance Center. And we're used to having you in front of an orchestra or making music. You're going to be lecturing here in Tulsa. Well, what was interesting in accepting this? I mean, a conductor such as yourself, you could work every night you wanted in front of an orchestra, and yet you're going to be speaking to people in Tulsa. What was the interest in doing this?
Because I think I have things to say which are impossible for me to communicate when I'm conducting. The importance for all this music for me is the way it has informed, transformed my life, and the way I think it is a stream that can exist, a beautiful stream, a very nurturing and ennobling stream that can be part of people's lives. The whole music experience and how it has evolved evolutionarily in society is something that greatly fascinates me. What music has been in earlier societies, what it is in primitive societies, in village musical life, in what it was in the developing city-states of Europe, what it is now as the whole tech influence has affected so much its distribution and its perception. All these things are vital issues for me and things that I'm very delighted to speak about.
I want to ask about another quote that you once said, and it was a very telling quote because it gets back to something we just mentioned a moment ago. You're talking about being a tour guide or maybe a curator would be another word of introducing people to new ideas and new music. And you said, in the rest of the arts, I think you were making the comparison, though, to contemporary art. When you think of any other art form, new contemporary pieces are open people approach them with open arms, whether it's even opera or music theater, television, visual arts, contemporary art. The next new thing is the big thing. But in classical music, contemporary music is often treated at arm's length. Why is there that difference in your view?
Part of it may be that listening is a more sophisticated skill than seeing.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to a museum and you see a very large abstract canvas, you can immediately see that in the overall plan of that there's this squiggle over here and this mark over here and this glyph over there, and that there's a certain push and pull that's taking between these things, and that there's an overall texture that might be part of the color field of the piece. And you can take the whole thing in, and then you can, at your leisure, look at one little portion or another and study it more and then grow to have a sense of how it all relates. And also, you're very much in control of that because you can look at it, you can look away from it, you can go and look at something else, you can come back and look at it again. You know, the experience is much more immediately available to you. In music, because it's taking place in time, you have to have skills to be able to perceive what you're hearing and remember it and be able to relate to things that happen in other parts of the piece. So it's part of the nature of music, and sometimes even the greatest music, that it is not going to completely reveal itself to you on first hearing. And there have been some composers, 20th century composers, to come to mind immediately, Charles Ives and Alban Berg, and these are two composers who wrote very complex, deep, profound music, much of it confrontational and puzzling. But they also had the ability to write somehow in each piece at least a few moments that would be, even on first hearing, utterly ravishing and beguiling. And that by hearing this piece, this was my reaction to them as a boy when I heard them, that I would hear this piece and say, oh my gosh, that is so beautiful. I'm just transported by that. Now, what about all the rest of this? Now, why is the rest of this so spiky and difficult? And what do I have to learn about this? Why would someone who could write something that would be this luscious on first hearing to experience decide to do all these other things? Well, that was puzzling and intriguing enough for me to understand that I wanted to go back and see how it all related. And, of course, over the years, I've come to a point of understanding that really every moment in those pieces is very much the beautiful moments. It's just that they're seen from oblique perspectives which change one's perception of them.
Well, it's interesting you say that because oftentimes even popular music on first hearing, it might leave us cold until we begin to hear it through repetition. All of a sudden it makes a lot more sense to us. Is it just that simple, you think?
Yes, but I mean, music that's written in a very very accessible medium. I kind of have to answer that in two different ways.
Yeah.
A lot of pop music is written to be beguiling, attractive instantly, and then not be so attractive in
repeated listenings, yes.
Yes, exactly.
Because
It defies a certain moment, and then it's supplanted by something else, which is the next moment. And it very often is not so much about traditional musical elements like harmonies and bass lines and melodies even, but increasingly about the sort of production and presentation of the tune, which has a certain attractive jangle that makes it play as it does. And it may have a certain briefly confrontational, socially confrontational side too, you know, which is fun.
Yeah.
The other thing about classical music that's interesting is, of course, it abstracts every music it encounters. You know, so inside of classical music, there is every pop music, every folk music, every kind of music that has ever been in Western civilization. There are the echoes of all of that music is there someplace inside of what classical music witnesses. So,
I think that's the interesting thing about contemporary music is that was seemingly lost for maybe a few years, and that has all come back in the last 30, 40 years, I would say.
Right. Well, there was in the 20th century, mid-20th century, later 20th century, a desire on some composers' parts to just sort of take music into completely intellectual realms. And Stravinsky expressed that very well. He said, there's some music that is composed not to be enjoyed, but to be admired. But I think we've sort of come around from that. And most of the young composers I know now are interested in exploring all kinds of new musical territories, but they really do have a much more kind of experiential agenda. They want people to get something about it that that haunts them. And, of course, that goes back to something that I say very often, which is that for me the most important moment in music is when the music stops. Because when the music ends, you then begin to know what of the musical message is sticking with you. What's hanging around? Is that a melody or a harmony or a rhythm or a mood? Or, you know, what is it? What is it that's sort of giving you a new sense of the flavor, the savor of life as experienced by someone else? And how does that add to your own experience?
My guest today is Michael Tilson Thomas. He'll be the first guest lecturer for this year's University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series, Tuesday night at the Lorton Performance Center. He joins us by phone. And one of the things I think you have done wonderfully in your career is try to provide the context for having those moments after the music stops. And it's involved everything from film to radio, your series of 13 Days When Music Changed Forever. Talking about the day Bach became the cantor in Leipzig, how that changed music completely. The premiere of The Rite of Spring, you know, which caused a musical riot, but it changed music utterly. And I was interested to read that perhaps you were part of the last classical music riot in 1973 at Carnegie Hall.
It was a real riot, that's for sure, yes.
Steve Reich's Four Organs premiere. Tell us about that evening.
It was a piece for four organs and maracas, and we began playing the piece, and people in the audience began to mumble and grumble and shout, and then some of them began really to try and prevent the performance from continuing. And so loud did the audience's protests become that even though the piece was amplified, we could not hear one another, and I was shouting out the numbers that would allow us, the players, to know where we all were with one another. And when we finished the piece, there was an avalanche of boos and hisses and whatnot, and also some people bravoing as loud as they could. And it was a very, very exciting moment. And Steve Reich, who was playing with us that night, was, of course, absolutely white as a sheet. He was just trying to absorb the intensity of the hostility. But as I said to him at that point, I said, wait a minute, there's also enormous enthusiasm. But the main thing is that as of tomorrow, everybody in the world is going to know all about you and your music.
Hmm. And that is definitely
That's
the
exactly
case.
Exactly what happened.
Yeah. Now, you opened your season with a new premiere by a familiar name, but the son of a famous composer, Samuel Carl Adams, the son of John Adams. I guess it had a great reaction, and critics were also saying, well, this is because he's the composer's son, but apparently the piece is great. You're going to play it again at Carnegie Hall in the spring. Mm-hmm. Is this the type of composer that you're talking about that engenders all this music of today?
Well, he's very interesting because, you know, he Sam Adams, is a jazz bass player, and most of his musical experience has been as a player of jazz in ensembles and whatnot. But at the same time, he has a big background in kind of musical statistical analysis from Stanford and places like this. So he's kind of looking at music from many different perspectives at once and evolving a new and rather haunted language. And I think it's no accident that he grew up here in San Francisco and experienced the musical culture of this city. There's a young composer now living out here in the Bay Area called Mason Bates, who's also been quite affected by his experience of being out here. So as I look at these composers, Sam Adams and Mason Bates and a number of others, well, so many composers came from the Bay Area, like Lou Harrison and Harry Parch, and of course John Cage was very much involved here in all sorts of ways. So there is this lovely tradition that comes out of San Francisco, which is influential in musical, American musical thought. It's one of the streams that is advancing the directions that our music is growing in. And I think for better, and perhaps sometimes for worse, American music has been the dominant musical influence in the world for at least 50, maybe 100 years, because not only the composers, but also the whole explosion of pop music and the whole technology of music, these things have really changed the concept of what music in the whole world is forever.
One last question about technology. Does that affect how you want to present a program as time goes on? I mean, you know, at one point you were the young generation. Now you're in your 60s. Technology is becoming every more a part of any sort of performance art. Does it need to be more part of the symphony orchestra in the traditional classical music setting?
Oh, it's becoming so. I mean, the question about technology is how to use it in a really personal way. This is something that I'm working on here in San Francisco and also with my orchestra of young musicians, the Academy of Young Musicians that I direct in Florida, which, as you may know, the New World Symphony has a building, has a center, which has been built specifically to explore possibilities of technology with regard to music and particularly classical music. Hey, Rich, I want to say one word here, though, about how pleased I am to be coming to Tulsa, where I've never been, but I have a lovely association with it because I've mentioned my father, who was a theater guy, and one of my father's dearest friends was a man called Ted Veman, Theodore Veman. I don't know if that name means anything to you. It's spelled V-I-E-H-M-A-N, and he was the head of the Tulsa Little Theater.
Oh, yes.
During the, that must have been like the 40s, 50s. And Ted Veman was a very sophisticated, knowledgeable theater guy who had worked a lot with really great old-timers like Morris Karnofsky and Judith Anderson and a lot of great stuff in the kind of the glory days of Orson Welles period in New York and also with people coming out of the Moscow Art Theater tradition. And always Ted was visiting us in California and describing these wonderful projects he was doing in Tulsa, and very much his mission of the idea that really great art, great work can be produced in all kinds of places, and that the kind of important personal center that the arts brings to people can really be a rallying force in communities. And this is a principle which I very much believe in. It also ties in with my grandparents' work, what their theater was like.
Right, the Yiddish theater.
That's right, the way it centered that community back in New York. And it has a lot to do with work that I've done in all sorts of places, including this project in Miami, where this new building and art orchestra over the last 25 years, the school that's there, has really become a new kind of center, cultural center for the for Miami Beach and greater Miami and Dade County. It's really having a transformative effect. So I'm very well aware of all these great cultural projects which have gone on over so many years and which continue in Tulsa, and I'm so anxious to experience them personally.
All right. Well, we look forward to your visit. Michael Tilson-Thomas, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Conductor Michael Tilson-Thomas will give the University of Tulsa a presidential lecture tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. That lecture is free and open to the public and sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Endowed Chair. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.